The following presentation was originally produced in video format by our friends at the Victoria Conference in Australia and can be seen on our website below the audio version. The audio format is made available with permission of the Victoria Conference in Australia. Special thanks to Miroslav Stekla, AV specialist, for his original composition and performance of intros and outros for Clifford Goldstein's series at Big Camp 25.
I grew up in a Jewish home, but it was very secular. And the way our family kind of kept the holidays, it was like, they try to kill us, they failed, let's eat. And that was the essence of my religious training. And I grew up also, because I was secular, I grew up very postmodern. And it was the idea, well, you have your truth, and that's your truth. You have your truth, and that's yours, and they're your truths. There's no overarching point. There's no God's eye view of what is truth and what isn't truth. If it's true for you, it's your truth. And truth was social, cultural, contingent. And that's how I believed, and I was passionate about that. And then one day, this was in, I was maybe 21 years old. I'm in a pizza parlor in Gainesville, Florida, where I was in school. And I'm reading a philosopher, I'm eating a pizza, and I joke, I'm drinking a non-Adventist beverage. And I'm reading this philosopher, and he said something that just instantly changed my life. It was something to the effect, in order to live the most perfect life, you need to find out the reason why you're here and live your life accordingly. Now, that might not sound like that big of a deal, but the way I've been explaining this for decades now, there was the pizza sitting on the table in front of me. Now, you could have had 1,000 different people with 1,000 different views on how they believe the pizza got there. The god Marduk created the pizza. It evolved out of the ground. Aliens dropped it out of a flying saucer. You could have had 1,000 different people with 1,000 different views, views that they would die for or maybe kill for. And maybe every single one of them was wrong. Maybe nobody could know the truth about where the pizza came from and why it was there. But somewhere out there, there had to be an explanation for the pizza. How it got there, why, what the purpose was. Well, then all I do is I just extended it out. I thought, well, I'm here. The world is here. The universe is here. Something had to explain it. Something had to explain the earth. Something had to explain the galaxies. And you just keep going back. And I realized something out there had to explain everything. And that was the truth. Well, then it just suddenly hit me. Wow, the truth had to exist. Now, you might think, well, Mickey Mouse could have told you that. But again, coming from the background that I came from, this realization that it was like, wow, truth, how do you? And I remember, well, it's funny, too, because my friends would tell me later, they'd say, hey, Cliff, we heard you had a vision of Jesus in a pizza parlor. Or we heard you found God in a pizza. Okay, but what happened was, I believe, a moment of just pure reason. The universe existed. Something had to explain it. And I remember I walked out of the pizza parlor and I walked down the street
And really, it was earth-shattering for me, the idea that truth had to exist. And I can still remember where I was. I'm walking down the street because my realization that truth had to exist, I mean, something had to explain this, was a total separate issue from whether I or anyone could know it. Two completely different metaphysics. The fact that it had to exist didn't mean in any way at all that I could ever know what it was. Even if I could, how would I even know? But what I remember the most is I'm walking down the street, and I don't know where I felt it so strong. I felt this pain. I could still remember exactly. I was in the town about 6 months ago, and I took a photo of the exact spot where I was walking, where it hit me. Wow, truth had to exist. And I remember thinking, if I could know it. Because again, my realization that it had to exist was totally separate from whether I could know it. But I thought, oh, if I could know it, I wanted to know it. I didn't care where it led me, what it cost me, what I had to suffer, what I had to give up. If I could know the truth, what created everything and why, I thought, I wanted to know it no matter what. And all I know is about 3 years later, I became a Seventh-day Adventist. Now, that's remarkable because growing up, I knew only one Adventist my whole life. And he used to sell the drugs. He was my dope dealer, the only Adventist I knew. And we would get high together, and he would witness to me about his faith. He would tell me, are these white Rastafarians or something? Because he smoked pot. So that was the only Adventist I knew. Plus, in my life, there were two kinds of people I used to hate. I hated Christians. I'm not kidding. I hated Christians, and I hated vegetarians. I was so carnivorous. I was so into eating meat. I used to mock vegetarians. I would mock them. So anyway, at that point too, though, my animosity towards Christianity was a lot more deeper-seated than my animosity towards vegetarians. Because even though I wasn't raised a religious Jew, for secular Jews, I mean, I knew more about, I could have named you every Nazi concentration camp in Europe and could have told you how many Jews they killed, but I couldn't tell you what book the Ten Commandments were in. I was raised on all this persecution of the Jews, all done in Christian lands, by people that went to churches and all this stuff done, and a lot of the stuff through the centuries, not so much the Nazis, though they were influenced in a Christian culture, in the name of Jesus and all that. And I was bitter against Christianity. I really was. And I was at the University of Florida in Gainesville, and there was this hellfire and brimstone preacher who used to come on the campus. His name was Jed Smock. And he'd stand out there with his Bible in his hand, and he'd just start preaching hell, fire, and brimstone. And there'd be a crowd of students around him in a circle. Well, I used to get in the center of the circle. I'd get on his heels. I'd curse him. I'd curse his mother. I'd curse his God. I could have gotten arrested for what I did to that guy. And he used to damn me that he swore there was no hope for me. He said, and he was a charismatic. And he put his hands on me to try to cast demons out of me. And I would writhe, and I would, you know, just acted silly. And my friends eventually nicknamed me Heckle. And this went on for a couple of years until I graduated college at the University of Florida. It's the mid-1970s. And at that stage of my life, I had one goal and one goal alone. I was going to be a novelist or nothing. And I had started a novel my senior year in college, and before long the book consumed me. All that mattered was my novel. I poured everything into it. I was an English major and studied creative writing, but you know, outside of a couple of poetry classes, I didn't think I got that much. All I wanted to do was write my novel. The novel controlled my life more than I control the characters in it. Well, I graduate college and I move back to Miami Beach. I grew up in Miami Beach. And I had a little bit of money left over from school, whatever, and I decided I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to go work on the novel in Europe. Because I had lived in Europe before and so on, and was just going to go back and just because I wanted part of the novel to take place there. So I end up going to Europe and I'm hitchhiking around England and I'm not getting anywhere. I'm not finding work. I've tried to find any kind of work. And I decide, all right, I'm going to go to Sweden because I had lived in Sweden a couple years earlier, was fairly fluent in the language. And I'm going to go back to Sweden and work on the novel there. So I'm hitchhiking through England, and the whole time I'm hitchhiking in England, it's raining on me. And then I take a boat from England to Holland. Well, if you've ever been to the Netherlands, it rains as much in the Netherlands as it does in England. And I'm walking down the gangplank, and it's cold, and it's windy, and it's raining. And I'm thinking, I'm going to go to Sweden, and there's a guy ahead of me with a backpack, as I had. And he had a sign on the backpack that I knew he was going to use for hitchhiking that said Greece. And I'm thinking, Greece, the beaches, you know, and I want to go, as I said, to Sweden. So I walk up to the guy and I said, hey, man, are you hitching to Greece? And he says, yeah. And I go, oh, what a coincidence. So am I. Let's hitchhike together. And just like that, I changed my mind. And instead of one side of the road going to Sweden, I'm on the other side with this guy trying to hitchhike the other direction to Greece. Well, two guys in the rain with backpacks were not getting rides. So I just split up with the guy and said, see you, whatever, okay? And it took me four long, hard, hot days. I practically walked through communist Yugoslavia, and I wind up in Athens, Greece. And I had the address of a friend of mine in college who lived there. And he says, oh, come, you can stay with me. I'll find you a job or whatever. So after 4 days on the road, I'm exhausted, and I finally take the bus, and I come to this house, and I knock on the door, and this little old lady comes out to the door, and I say, Faunus, is Faunus here? And she says, oh, Faunus no here, Faunus in Miami. So I let out kind of a wail, and she feels sorry for me. So she gives me a meal, and an hour later, I'm back out on the streets of Athens. I have no idea where I'm going to go. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I don't know where I'm going to sleep that night, okay? I just was, like, totally discombobulated. So finally, I found some bushes. I found some bushes along a wall, and I just laid out my sleeping bag, and I went to sleep. And that night, I had a dream. Now, you got to understand, I was as philosophical of a materialist as you would ever find. The whole world was just atoms in the void. If you couldn't explain it in principle through chemistry, through physics or whatever, it didn't exist. It was so I didn't take dreams seriously. Dreams were all dependent on what you ate for dinner and that your mother breastfeed you long enough as a baby, whatever. I didn't pay any attention to it. But that night I had a dream. And I was dreaming that I was sleeping in the bushes. Then I dreamt that I woke up, I booked the ticket, and flew to Israel to live on a kibbutz. For lack of a better term, just think of a commune. It's a lousy analogy, but I don't want to get into that now. To live on a kibbutz in Israel and work on my novel. That was my dream. And when I woke up, I thought, wow, that's really not a bad idea. And why I remember, right across the street, there was a travel agency. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, it opened. I still remember the sign, it opened at 9. So following the dream, I go to the agency, I book a ticket, I fly to Israel, and about 3 days later, I'm on a kibbutz in the north, right along the Golan Heights, working on the kibbutz and writing my novel, just as I had dreamt. Because again, the book was all that mattered to me. And I loved it on the kibbutz. I worked 30 hours a week, and the rest of the time was mine just to write the novel and read. And I just, because I poured everything into this book. Now, I want to give you two details on the kibbutz and their importance. Just remember them. When I was on the kibbutz, I had a blonde Danish girlfriend. Her name was Tina. Just remember a blonde Danish girl named Tina. The other thing, too, was, you know, I'm a reader, and I read a lot of poetry. I still read poetry, not as fanatical as I was back then. And there was this one book of poetry by a woman named Sylvia Plath. I don't know if any of you studied American poetry, whatever, but she was just, and it was very powerful stuff. And this one book impacted me greater than anything else I had read. When I told the story to friends later on the who lived on the kibbutz, I said, remember, I used to make you sit there and listen to me, whether you wanted to or not, read you this woman's poetry. So remember, Tina and Sylvia Plath. Anyway, I'm on the kibbutz, and after, I don't know, about 6 weeks, who should show up but a group of these fundamentalist Christians from America, the exact kind like that guy was whom I used to harangue. These are these evangelicals. They're really into Israel and prophecy and, you know, all the prophecies of Ezekiel and Isaiah all going to be filled, and the literal battle of Armageddon and 200 million man Chinese army is going to come down and attack Israel in the Valley of Megiddo, and the church is going to be raptured, and 12,000 Jewish virgins from the different 12 different tribes are going to preach the gospel. You know, that whole stuff, it's silliness to us, but they take it seriously, and they were there to witness to the Jews on the kibbutz. Well, I was furious. You know, I was in the boonies of the only Jewish state since the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, since like AD 135, and now you got all these Christians here? Well, I had years, I think it was terrible, I had years of experience harassing and mocking them, Christians, and I just got loose on them. And it got so bad that eventually the Jews on the kibbutz, the Israelis who ran the kibbutz, said, if you don't leave these people alone, we're going to kick you out of here. Okay, because they were good, hard workers, and I didn't get along with them that well anyway, with the Israelis that well anyway. So I just backed off, because at that point, all I wanted to do was work on my novel. And I will say this, and this is that, no matter how much I harangued those people and insulted them, they never stopped loving me. And that made an impact on me. Anyway, I'm on the kibbutz for about a year. I've put now over about 2 years in my novel. And I decide I'm going to go back to Europe to work on the novel in Europe as I originally intended.
So I left Israel and I hitchhiked up, and I ended up hitchhiking up to Denmark, to Copenhagen. And years earlier, there had been a vast military barracks in Copenhagen, and the army had abandoned it, and all these hippies and these squatters moved in. It was a place called Christenia, and it was like an alternate community in the middle of the city, like a big hippie commune. And I had been there before, and I remembered it differently. And I was going to have part of my novel take place there. And I went back up, and man, the place was really just kind of a hellhole. I think half the drug addicts in Europe were there, half the fugitives. I mean, I had remembered it one way, but it really was kind of, it wasn't really that nice of a place. And it was kind of, wait a minute, this isn't how I remembered it. But anyway, to give you an idea what it's like, I'm there maybe 2 days, and I'm walking through this muddy courtyard, and I hear this woman screaming. And I look over, and some woman's on the ground, and some guy's stomping her and kicking her, and she's screaming. I don't need to get involved in this, you know, and I try to walk away, but my conscience is bothering me, so I walk over, and as soon as I walk over, he stops beating on her, and she gets up and runs away. So I thought, I did my good deed for the day, and I start to walk away. Well, this guy's some strung-out little junkie. I'm not looking, and when I'm not looking, he just turns around and just punches me right in the mouth, just slams me right in the mouth. Now, I mean, I ain't all that big. I ain't all that heavy. I mean, I maybe weigh 160 pounds dripping wet, okay? But when I was in college, I used to box. I boxed on a bag all the time. Box, box, box. That's how I got my exercise. And I went into the boxing ring one time, and I never did it again. I went back to the bag because the bag never hit me back. Okay, I got pulverized in the ring. Well, anyway, the guy punches me. Well, it's just reflexes. I just turn around and boom, 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 1, 2, 3, just laid him out. As I said, he was some strung-out little junkie. Well, what happened, though, is when he punched me, he knocked my glasses off. And believe me, I can't see a soul. I don't even know I'm looking at people right now. Okay, my eyes are so bad, they wouldn't even do LASIK on me. And I can't find my glasses, and I don't want to be groping around in the mud for my glasses. So I grab this guy by the head, and I go, find my glasses, find my glasses. So I get my glasses, and I say to this guy, I said, look, man, I don't want you to go get marriage counseling or something, you know, whatever. And I take them and I throw them on the ground. Well, I've got a weak knee and a weak back. And as luck would have it, throwing them on the ground, instantly they both give out on me. And then the guy gets up and he pulls out a knife and says, I'm going to kill you, man. And he comes after me with the knife. Well, boxing or no boxing, you don't fight somebody with a knife if you can get away. So I just run away. And at this, my knee and my back didn't need it. But it was like out of, do you guys know who the Keystone Cops are? It was like the Keystone Cops. I'm running down the street going, help, police, help. And he's chasing me with the knife. Well, amazingly enough, the cops come. They take us down to the police station, and an hour later, the cop says, well, we got to let him go, because according to Danish law, the knife isn't long enough to make an arrest. Okay, so great. So I'm back out. You know, my knee's killing me. My back's killing me. I got a fat lip from where he punched me in the mouth. And then I'm leaning over I have to look over my shoulders. They might have even given the guy his knife back. And I'm leaning over my shoulder, worried about this guy. Now, the reason I'm telling the story is things are not going particularly well for me at this point.
And then to top it off, I mean, I met a guy who I met, or, you know, I never tell people how, you're going to have a hard enough time believing what I tell you now. I never bother to give people the background of the story because no one's going to believe that. But I knew a guy who lived in another part of the city, a nice part, actually. And I go to visit him, and this guy was really into the occult, really into spiritualism. You know, none of that stuff made any sense to me, but his apartment was so creepy, and he would just get so creepy. I mean, he was just spooking me in this place. And then he would get in these drunken stupors, and he'd sit in a chair for hours, days on end, and not get up. He'd soil himself, and he'd stomp the ground, and he'd shriek, and he'd wail, and he'd make noises and howl. I mean, just not, I mean, I'd never seen anything like it. And I looked at this guy, and I don't know what to do. This guy needs anything. So me, of all people, I said, hey, man, you need something. Have you ever thought about Jesus? And the moment I said the name Jesus to him, he stopped the stomping, and he looks up at me with one eye. Don't ask me what the one eye thing was. And he looks up at me, and he says, 20 years ago, I asked for Jesus. Instead, I got the devil. Okay, now, folks, Jesus, the devil, Buddha, Santa Claus, the good tooth fairy, none of that stuff meant anything to me. But he so freaked me out with that. I said, that's it. I'm out of here. And I just had to get out of there. And between my knee and my back, and I traveled enough to know you can't get away from yourself. Said, I got to get out of this place. And I go to Paris. And I'm going to try to find some work in Paris. And then on top of it, I've been on the road alone, and I'm lonely, and I got personal issues and just things. The bottom line is my life was spiraling down, down, down. And I still remember exactly where I was, because I remember telling my wife, who's heard the story a jillion times, at this part, we were in Paris, and I said, right here is where I was standing. And I'm looking up at the Eiffel Tower. And the thought was, it was the only time in my life I said, okay, you could do A, you could do B, or you could kill yourself. And I looked up at the Eiffel Tower from the spot, and I thought about jumping off the Eiffel Tower. And as soon as I had that thought, this other thought came and kind of, boop, knocked that thought out. And the thought was, hang on, Cliff, because maybe this Jesus stuff is true. And yet, as soon as I said that, I just cursed myself. I said, look at you. Your whole life you viewed religious people as weak people. Oh, they couldn't handle the hard knocks of life. And though they had their Buddha that they bow down to, or their Jesus they pray to, or their Mary, and they all this. And my whole life it was like, bleh. I just thought it was the weakest, cheapest, stupidest crutch you could imagine. And then I'm thinking, now for the first time in my lousy 23 years of life, I can't handle it. So I'm going to reach out to some voodoo god or someone or whatever, anybody, just in order to make me feel better. I thought, there's no way. I'd rather live with no hope than a false hope. I would have rather have jumped off the Eiffel Tower and be dead than live a lie. Because again, I was a seeker for truth. I'd rather be dead than live a lie now, no matter how good the lie made me feel. And I can still remember too, now whether I shook a fist up in the sky or not, I don't remember. But I thought, God, if you exist, you've got to reveal yourself to me. I need a sign. And little did I know that the Bible said, I only read this years later, Greeks seek for wisdom, Jews seek for a sign. I said, God, I need a sign. Other words, I will never believe ever. And with that, I left and I went back to Israel because I just wanted to get back on my novel. I put over 2 years in it now. All that mattered was me working on the book. And I go back to my old kibbutz and they won't let me back. They won't let me come back. And I told some of the Christians what happened in Paris. I said, all right, if God is there, he's got to reveal himself to me. I'm not just going to believe. And one of the guys said, if you ask, he will. All right, fine. Anyway, so I decide, all right, I'm going to go to another kibbutz. And you just don't walk up to a kibbutz and knock on the door. You go to an office, a main office, and there's an office in Tel Aviv, and there's a funny story how I just happened to get there, but I don't have time for that now. But I go to the office to get assigned to a kibbutz, and I walk into a room, and there's a woman at the desk, and sitting near the desk along a wall is a boy ahead of me, and he was there to get assigned to a kibbutz. And I walk in the room, and before I sit down, I look on the desk. I look on the desk, and I see a sheet of paper. And it has my name, Clifford Goldstein, on the sheet of paper. And I interrupted the woman with the talking to the boy and said, how did you know I was coming? And she says, who are you? And I point to the paper, Clifford Goldstein. Well, the boy who was sitting there, he jumps up and said, no, that's mine. My name is Clifford Goldstein. All right, I mean, Clifford Goldstein's not the most common name in the world. But again, I was in Israel, Tel Aviv. And I said, Cliff, where are you from? And he said, I grew up in Miami Beach. And when I told my mother the story, she nodded. She said, when you guys were kids, you shared the same pediatrician, and some of his bills would come to our house that were his bills, not mine. And then he wanted to go to a kibbutz. And I said, Cliff, you go to my old kibbutz and just tell him your name is Clifford Goldstein and you're from Miami Beach. And see what happens. Well, he goes to the kibbutz. He goes, and I get assigned to another kibbutz. But I'm not getting my act together, and I'm going to come home. I mean, I'm running around like with a chicken with my head cut off. I'm just trying to work on my book. And so I decide I'm going to go home. So I come back to the kibbutz for a visit. Well, of all, there were like maybe 30 different rooms for the volunteers. Of all the different rooms, Clifford Goldstein was sleeping, and he was in the same room that I had been in when I had left months earlier. There were two beds in the room, and he was sleeping in the same bed that I had been sleeping in. So we're sitting there in the room and we're talking. And we admit this is a little freaky, but you know, whatever. And then as we're talking, I look up on the bookshelf over the bed. Now, as I said, I was a writer. I read. And I had just left when I hitchhiked up to Denmark. I couldn't take my library with me. So I had left all my books right on the bookshelf. And I see the books up there and I said, hey, Cliff, you like my books? And he says, what are you talking about? He said, those are all my books. And I said, no way. And I reach up and I go for the volume of poetry by Sylvia Plath, the exact volume, exact copy, you know, the same edition. And I flip through it because it's not my book. And I looked through it, and who reads this stuff? And I said, Cliff, are you a writer? And he says, you know, I think I want to be a writer. Okay, then as we're talking,
this girl walks into the room. I'd never seen her before. It's his girlfriend. She's blonde. She's from Denmark. And her name is Tina. Okay.
But on this part, everybody just gives me these looks. I'm telling you, this is what happened. So it was funny because the Christians, I mean, what do I do with this? And one of the Christians on the kibbutz said, Cliff, you're asking God for signs. He says, what more do you want? He says, man, the Lord is calling you by name. And when he said that to me, it was like, I remember I stepped outside and I'm thinking about this. And I know this can't be a coincidence. If it's not a coincidence, what is it? And I'm telling you, it was the first time in my life I looked up in the sky with a little bit of fear and a little bit of reverence because I just knew there had to be something else out there. But anyway, this gets even crazier. These Christians whom I harangued and harassed the whole year, they took me down to the Jordan River, they baptized me, and they gave me a Bible, and I come back to the States. Okay. The only problem is I was really no more born again than a corpse. I mean, it was heavy meeting my double, and that just said, man, there's gotta be more out there. I didn't know what, but nothing changed in my life. I didn't have any experience with God, had no relationship with God. All I wanted to do was work on my novel, and I was back in Gainesville eking out an existence while I'm writing my novel. Now, I want to backtrack a little because this plays in. I laid down one afternoon in Israel after I came back to take a nap. And as I laid there, I felt the strange tingling in my toes. And it rolled up my body, and I felt this loud pounding in my head, and I had the sensation I was getting hurled through a wind tunnel. And I sat up, and I thought, man, what was that? It was very unpleasant. Well, it started to happen to me again and again, and I come back to Gainesville. And it's happening, and I said to myself, the next time this happens, don't fight it. And so one afternoon, I'm laying there, and I feel this tingling in my toes and this rolling up and this pounding in my head, and I say, don't fight it, don't fight it. And the next thing I know is zoosh. I feel myself, I go right out of my body. I go right through the roof, and the next thing I know, I'm hovering in the air in this gray crackly mist outside the second story apartment of some friends of mine who are into Guru Maharaja. You probably don't know Guru. And the next thing I know, boom, I'm back in my body. Now look, folks, I'm a hardcore Seventh-day Adventist today. I know today that there's no such thing as a separate, conscious, immortal soul. I mean, I know that passionately. I know that now, but there was nothing that anybody could have convinced me back then that that was anything other than my soul leaving my body. Okay, and it was exactly like all read near-death experiences? Exact phenomena. I wasn't anywhere near death, but I thought, this is my soul, and I thought, wow, maybe the truth is in the occult. And in spiritualism, maybe that's the truth that I'm looking for. So I already, and this is the part that freaks me out, I just started weaving this. I started writing about this in my novel. In other words, I'm beginning to write about this. I didn't know where it was going to go. Then I decide, okay, I got to study the occult because maybe this is the truth that I'm looking for. And so I'm walking over to the library at the University of Florida, to get a book on the occult. And I'm a starving writer. I need a job. And there's a health food store, you know, with the hated vegetarians. What will a man give in exchange for his soul? So I'm going to go and ask for a job. And I meet the guy in the health food store. And I tell him what I'm into. And he goes, "What?" And he pulls me in the store and he locks the door. And then he starts warning me about Satan and the demonic. "Well, you're all telling me it's Satan." He might as well have told me Santa would come down the chimney at Christmas to talk to me about Satan. But he goes, "Here, read this book." So I'm a writer. I'm a reader. I read everything. So he gave me the book. I never saw it before. And I go over to the library and I get a book on the occult. And I wasn't in school. I couldn't check it out. So I sat there in the library and I read the first chapter and practiced the first technique that said, stare at a point at the back of your head. Okay, so I don't know, whatever, I did it. So I go to put the occult book back on the shelf. But here's the bottom line, folks. I'm walking through the library, and literally in one hand, I have the occult book, first time in my life. And in my other hand, first time in my life, I got the book the guy handed me in the health food store. Occult book in one hand. What do you think the other book was? The Great Controversy. One book in one hand. And I was clueless. I was utterly clueless. I just started reading a little of The Great Controversy, but had no idea what was going on. Well, about two nights later, it's the fall of 1979. I'm 23 years old. I'd been working on my novel now for 2.5 years. As I said, nothing else mattered than the book. It was my life. It was actually going better that night than it had gone since I started. Now, you know, you asked me, did I believe in God? Did I believe in Jesus? Between meeting my double, and you have these supernatural occult experiences, and you know there's another realm out there. You know there's a greater reality out there. So yeah, I believe Jesus was all right, but you know, I didn't. Whatever. All that mattered to me was my novel. So I walked back to my room. Sun was setting. And I sit down to work on my book. And I have a manual typewriter there. And for some reason, I don't know why, and I know this just how the Great Controversy, right before I started to write, I close my eyes and I uttered a prayer. I don't know who I prayed to. I don't think it lasted 3 seconds. But somehow in what Adventist theologian John Peckham calls the rules of engagement, I mean, Satan had me. He had me. I was having occult experiences. I started studying it. This is a part that really freaks me. I started writing about it. He had me. And yet somehow I closed my eyes in that little prayer. That was all the Lord needed. And I turn around to put my fingers on the typewriter. And at that moment, the presence of the Lord Jesus Christ came to me in the room. I knew instantly who he was. And I knew instantly what he wanted. And his exact words to me were, "Cliff, you have been playing with me long enough. If you want me tonight, burn your novel." It was simple as that. In that instant, he showed me that was my God. It really was my God. And I didn't know anything about the Bible. I didn't know there was a Bible text that said, "You shall have no other gods before you." But instantly, I saw that was my, and I just thought, no way. I said, "God, please, please, I'll write it all in your glory. If you want me tonight, burn the book. Please let me finish it, and then I'll give my life to you. If you want me, burn the book. Please, let's deal with this later. If you want me tonight, burn the novel. Two things stand out for me. The total reality of free will. I mean, look, my brain could turn to Lucite trying to understand the philosophical arguments for or against free will. But two things, I knew it was my choice. And secondly, don't ask me why, but now that I had this sense, because I would have ended up doing what I do and I would have ended up writing for the occult, but I wasn't thinking about that. I had this sense, if I don't do this now, I will never have the opportunity again. Well, at that point, I couldn't burn the book. And I just burst into tears and I jumped up and I ran out of the room. And I was running. These were the same streets in Gainesville. I'm running out of time here. Same streets. Well, I told them, I flew 8,000 miles to get here. I'm going to finish my story. Okay, I flew 8,000 miles to get here. But anyway, sorry about that, wherever they go. Okay, all right. And anyway, because I'm usually, trust me, nothing is going to be as long as this. But this is the best story. This is the best I got for the weekend. But anyway, I'm walking, and I just can't do it. But these were the same streets of Gainesville that I walked through when I said I wanted truth no matter the cost. And now I'm confronted with the cost. And I remember I'm just wrestling with God through the streets. And then finally I stop underneath the street lamp. And I still remember the bugs were flying around and casting shadows. And finally I said, okay, God, I want you. I want truth more than I want this book. But if you want it burned, you're going to have to burn it for me. And as soon as I made that choice, you know, God didn't force, but I did sort of feel his grip around my neck. But as soon as I made that choice, everything lifted. And I knew exactly what I was going to do. And I went back to the room. If you would have said to me that night I was a sinner, I would have had no idea what you were talking about. All I knew is I met God, I met Jesus that night, and this is what I had to do. I went back to the room. I had this two-burner hot plate that my mother had given me, hoping I'd cook a meal. Fat chance of that. And she asked my wife trying to get me after she leaves something at home. You mean I got to put it in the microwave? And she says, eat it cold then, I don't care. But I picked up the manuscript 2.5 years. I said, I had no idea I was even a sinner. And I put the manuscript on the hot plate, turned the knob, and burned the novel. And that was the night I was became a born-again believer. And those occult experiences, as I said, near death, these people flow out of their bodies and they meet their dead relatives. See, here's the thing. Satan overplayed his hand on me. I can't prove it, you know, through science, through psychology, whatever. But you see, I know. But when I burned the novel, those occult experiences never came back. And then I just met Adventists in the health food store and was studying with them. And that, yeah. Or you're not going to, okay, I'm just telling you the story. About 2 months go by, or maybe 6 weeks, I'm studying with the Adventists in the health food store. I'm getting ready to cross the street, and a car drives by. And I think, do I want to race, or do I run? I'll wait. And the car drives by. Who do you think's in the car? Clifford Goldstein The last time I saw him was on the kibbutz in Israel.
Now, I'm pretty sure I found, he won't have anything to do with me. He's scared. I think he's scared. I found him on Facebook. He won't answer anything. Now, it's funny. There's another Clifford Goldstein who's much younger, and he's a gynecologist. And, oh, it's every now, oh, it gets so sticky. Because every now and then his patients email me thinking I'm him. And you can't believe the things they're telling me. And I got to say, hey, I'm sorry you got the wrong Clifford Goldstein. But anyway, I was born again. And when I burned that novel, I realized I might not ever write again. Oh, the other thing too, that preacher I used to harass, he came back and I got in the center of the circle with him. And he probably thought, here we go again. Only this time I witnessed with him. Many of them remembering me as heck. Well, anyway, when I burned that novel, I thought I was done writing. That was it. I didn't know what I was going to do. Then one day the door opened for me to write an article. And I wrote it and I got it published. And you know what it was on? Of course not. It was on the health benefits of vegetarianism. And the point is, I've been writing ever since. The Lord gave it back to me.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. Free listening and sharing of this message, and over 8,000 other presentations by more than 100 speakers on 50 different topics, is now available at our American Christian Ministries mobile app for Android and Apple devices, and on our secure website, or call 800-233-4450 if you are in the USA or Canada. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help to prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.